Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have two wonderful astronomers with us in our Milwaukee studios, and we're going to have some fun this hour. First, though, let me tell you that we need to thank you, many of you who contributed to our One Day Wednesday pledge drive. It was very successful. We had 2,500 listeners who pledged. We welcomed 375 new members, and you donated $266,000 in a one-day drive, which is fabulous, to fund Wisconsin Public Radio and all of the programs that you depend on. So thanks ever so much. Joining us in our studios, two great astronomers, and there is a new show, and there will be a lecture tonight at the Planetarium, which is at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Bob Berman has joined us. You'll be familiar with his name on many occasions on the air here. He is the Strange Universe columnist for Astronomy Magazine. I brought in his 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos, which is a great, I hope you can still get this, it's not that old, fall of 2011. It's really fascinating. He's the author of a number of books, including The Sun's Heartbeat and other stories from the life of the star that powers our planet. He leads these expeditions all over the world to see phenomenal things in the sky. And he's with us because he's doing a presentation tonight, which we will hear about at the Planetarium. A great pleasure to meet you in person. And thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you,
Kathleen. It's great to have you here. Also with us in studio, we met him yesterday because he gave us a look at the night sky, and also we saw the colors exhibit, which is at the Planetarium. The exhibit just opened. Bob Bonadour is Planetarium Director for the Milwaukee Public Museum. He has also hosted many astronomical events for eclipses, meteor showers, and solstice celebrations. He's led three total solar eclipse tours to various parts of the world and has worked on educational grants from NASA. And we thank him very much for his hospitality yesterday and for being with us today. Thank you, Bob, so much.
You're most welcome.
Yeah. So tonight, let's talk about the first order of business, which is tonight there is a lecture that Bob is giving, and you're also going to do the show. Does it open tonight? Did we see it early?
It opened this week, so you saw it a little early, but we had this event scheduled, and we just thought Bob is a great combination for the show because he's written many columns on color. He really has a great insight to it, so we thought it was the perfect complement to the show.
Yeah, and what are you talking about tonight? It's always something new with
yes.
you, right?
Yes, it's astonishing. I have to be careful that I don't just blah, 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 because it's just so much. It's so amazing. We use light and color and vision, of course, in our lives. We're not dogs. We don't rip up the garbage. We don't care about smells. Color and light is the only way we find out about the universe. We astronomers, we can't hear anything. We can't touch anything in space. And so it's very, very vital. But if you ask most people, what is light? What is it? How is it born? How is light created? I don't think one person in 1,000 knows. It's actually very simple. But so the simple things about light and color, this is to celebrate the great new planetarium show that Bob has created and will be running this week. But we're going to supplement that with some demonstrations and cool stuff and a little magic and things like that tonight.
I always love to hear the stories. I've asked you this before, Bob Berman, but I haven't asked you, Bob. There is something that happens to us, I think, when we're really young and we sit on the grass or out in a prairie and look up at the sky, and it's almost this otherworldly experience that we imagine ourselves as very small or very unimportant, but we just can't quite take in mm-hmm. all that's there or all that may be beyond what it is we're seeing. When did that happen with both of you? When did you say, holy Toledo, this is incredible, this universe we're living in, and I'm going to study this for my life's work?
Well, me, it was a little late, and it was in high school.
Really? Well, that's not that late.
But I connected it just looking at the sky. We had our physics class did a little astronomy and told us to get out there. And I had been aware of it, but it was that direction by the teacher and got me out there. And I said, yeah, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to teach astronomy. I want people to connect to this just awesome universe. And that's what the planetarium does. It reminds us that there's this great universe out there and we should visit it and get and discover it more.
Yeah. Bob, how about you?
For me, I think it was just destiny. I think everything is destiny, really. But my first a memory of life was looking out of a baby carriage or a stroller. I don't know what it was. I don't think I had language then. But I remember looking up out of the sides of something into the night sky. So it's the first thing I can remember is the stars. And so when I was a kid, I would memorize their names and distances and spectral classes. My friends were memorizing baseball cards, which was big back then. But I just always loved it.
Yeah. And the last book that we talked to you about was the Sun book, which was really a wonderful book. And then we saw the show on color. And I remember, and I've told this story to a lot of people, the part of the book where you talk about the color green. And I want both of you to talk about the color green, because there's a reason that we see a lot of green, that things are green. The sun, tell me about green.
Yeah, because green is the primary, is the maximum emission from the sun. Most people would guess, well, maybe it's ultraviolet that burns us at the beach, or the infrared, the heat that we can feel on our skins. But the peak emission is green light. And our eyes were constructed to see by sunlight. So our eyes see green most readily. And in late twilight, before night has fully settled, when all the other colors have faded to gray, we can still see green when we can see nothing else. And even that's a little bit unintuitive. If most people look at a lawn or leaves at this magical time of year now and everything is turning green, people would think, well, grass, chlorophyll, leaves must love the green color of the sun. But it's not really true. What happens is we see green because that's the color that they don't like. In other words, the sun puts out the full rainbow of colors, as we all know, the spectrum of colors. And grass lives by taking in blue, mostly blue, but it'll also feed on red. But it doesn't like green. So it rejects it. It reflects it away. So when we see a green lawn, it's not because the grass loves green. It's because it hates green. We're seeing the rejected color. So there's a lot of quirks like that to the sky. The real sky is violet. Because there's something called Rayleigh scattering, where the shorter the wavelength, the more the light bounces around among our atmospheric molecules. So there's more violet light bouncing around than blue, but our eyes are so insensitive to violet, way off in the fringe of the spectrum, that we instead see the next most abundant color in the sky, which is still pretty prevalent, which is the blue. But some birds and insects see the true violet color of the sky.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's 1,000 quirks like that.
Huh.
Yeah, and in the show, we'll take you inside a plant cell and show you the big chlorophyll, chloroplast. And I think I read one of your columns, but isn't the interstate signs green because it's the last color we see? It's one of the most prevalent. That's why they designed it
yes.
that way?
That's right, the interstate highway signs, and that's why more buses or fire trucks, actually, are being painted green instead of red.
Hmm.
Because our eyes are more sensitive to that color. And lots of quirks. Before we came in here, one of them is yellow, that we assume that's a real color, but almost all the yellow we see in life is really just green and red. And whether it's the directional signal of a car or butterfly or butter, if you use a spectroscope,
which he brought, and everybody's been fascinated with ever since he walked through the front door. John Gerda and Bob were looking at all the colors everywhere. Through. Yeah, you've carried it with you. That's great, Bob.
Everything that looks yellow, if you really look at it through a spectroscope, which shows what the light really is, it's just green and red. And so lots of stuff, lots of interesting light stuff that I think everybody can relate to because we're light based mammals.
Right. And tell me what a spectroscope is. I remember on one show you said we should all go out and get one. It would be the best spending of money that we ever spent in our whole lifetime.
Yes. Using either a grating or a series of prisms, it does the same thing a little bit of cut glass on your windowsill would do. And that is, it takes the colors that are actually present in light, and instead of them scrambling up together and mixing together in our eyes, it spreads them out so we can see what they are side by side instead of getting them all at once. So this way we can see what's really in the light. Look out at a cloud and you see the spectrum of the sun. And look at the fluorescent tube in a room. It's a very different light. They both look
yes.
white.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, well, I don't know, those fluorescent lights, they feel different. They just feel a little creepy. They don't feel the same. And yet they're the same white as we'd see from a cloud. But a spectroscope shows you, well, that's why it feels different. It is different.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are white because we'll see white anytime we get all three of light's primary colors, which are red, green, and blue, in more or less equal amounts. We'll perceive this as white. But the sun does it with an addition of all the other colors of the spectrum, oranges and violets and everything in between. The fluorescent lights only have a narrow band because it's glowing mercury really inside and argon. And so we're seeing just a very narrow little color of a specific type of blue and red and green and nothing in between. So no oranges. There's no violets. There's no other colors coming from those tubes. Do we need them for our health? Who knows? But they are different from sunlight.
Hmm. Now, tell me about the show that you've done on color. Why you put this all together, Bob?
Sure.
Why have you done color? As I saw it, the other thing I wanted to say was, I just walked out of that planetarium seeing colors for. We shouldn't take them for granted. We shouldn't take color for granted. It's
right.
It makes our world so much more interesting.
Oh yeah,
that's
a great curiosity. I mean, we live in color. This world of color, and I think. One of the most common questions, for example, you know, Bob touched on, why is the sky blue? We want to remind people that there's a reason why the sky is blue, and that's the whole process of science and investigating and discovery, and that is our mission at the museum, at the planetarium, is to wake people up that. And so we look for ideas that that are obvious, sort of, and we can connect. And cosmic colors is great. So as you saw the show, we tried to provide an Earth example of why things are certain colors, and then we take them out into space and tell them why it's a certain color. And then, as you saw, we do the invisible color, the invisible part of the spectrum, and just, you know, why? Because, you know, for years, astronomers only saw a small part of the universe, the visible part that we could see with our eyes. And then within the last 100 years, it's opened up to radio energy mm-hmm. and light from space, X-ray, and we've discovered black holes and supernovas and so many things. So the universe, we're seeing a much better picture because of the invisible universe. And invisible universe, we use that here all the time, as you saw the examples with, like, ultraviolet light to spot counterfeit money. You know, we're using these things, you know, our microwaves for not only our ovens, but for, you know, cell phones, and we turn on the TV with infrared. I mean, it's just all around us.
And why are some of those rays harmful for us?
Well, they're just more energetic. They're more powerful. They're moving very fast, and they will hurt you. But we're kind of lucky, or very lucky, and the reason we're here is because our atmosphere protects us from the harmful rays out there in space, the X-rays, the gamma rays, the ultraviolet, some does slip through and, of course, can cause danger to our skin and so forth. But we're protected in this beautiful atmosphere that we have.
What color is the sun, Bob Berman?
The sun is actually white. This is very cool because Bob was just talking about space and what we've seen lately. And one of the interesting, I think, aspects of it is astronauts report that the sun is as white as snow. And yet here on Earth,
as white as snow.
As white as
really?
Snow. And yet some books mistakenly say, well, the sun is spectral class G1, and that's a yellow star. Or if you hand any kid a box of crayons and say, all right, draw a picture of the sun, they'll always use yellow.
Right.
And the sun does look a little lemony yellow here. But that's fascinating, too. And what's happening is that on its way through the atmosphere, the blue part of the sunlight is being scattered out to give us our blue sky. Now, we didn't get this blue sky for nothing, for free. This was robbed from the incoming sunlight. So the sun that we see is missing some of its blue. Well, if you take the blue away, you're left with a overabundance of green and red. And green and red combined make
yellow,
which is, you know, what we were just saying. So the sun looks yellow because some of its blue has been robbed to give us our blue sky. And so what I'm saying is that the blue sky and the yellow sun go together. They create each other. You can't have a blue sky without also having a yellow sun instead of the true white color of the sun.
Oh, what a nice way to think of it.
You can recombine them and see what the astronauts see on a, I don't want to use the word snow at this point in the season, but on a clear day on a snowy field. You're looking at the field being lit up not just by the slightly yellowish sun, but also by the blue sky. So the colors recombine, and the color of snow on a clear day shows you the true color of the sun as seen by astronauts.
Mm. How much longer does the sun have?
Well, it has a good 5 billion years until it turns into first a red giant that will probably expand just about to our orbit. That won't be good. But unfortunately, we only have 1.1 billion years because...
Really?
Yeah. It'll start getting hotter by then.
Oh.
It's getting 10% hotter every billion years. Now, the past few billion years, we've been able to compensate by the atmosphere's changed. The greenhouse gases that have such a bad reputation have actually saved us because there are more of them now than there back then there were more methane. There was more greenhouse gases. So as the sun has gotten hotter, there have been periods where Earth's climate has changed. But by and large, we have been spared by natural changes on the Earth. But we can't anymore. One more 10% boost, which will happen in the next billion years, and we're out of compensatory mechanisms, and no one can figure out a way to stop the Earth from being 700 degrees worldwide, the oceans boiling off, and air conditioning will be definitely standard then on cars. So it won't be optional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have it.
Yeah. So, do you want to add to that? Do scientists agree on that?
Yeah, they agree on that most definitely. It's just not something, warn our listeners, it's not something to worry about today. I mean, a billion years is a long time,
right.
Long time. But it is a fact. I mean, the sun. But and I went connected. You know, there may be some listeners who think, well, if the sun's getting hotter, isn't that the reason for climate change? And it's not. I mean, it billion years is a
That's right.
Incredibly long time.
There's an old one of the oldest astronomy jokes is the student who says, "Professor, did you just say that the sun is going to make Earth uninhabitable in a million years?" And the teacher says, "No, it's a billion years." And the student says, "Oh, whew, I thought you said a million years."
Well, Bob and I talk. Big numbers are important to communicate. Carl Sagan, in one of his books, had the analogy, you know, a million seconds from now is only 12 days from now.
Huh.
A billion seconds from now is almost 32 years. So we tell this to the kids all the time, and you know, on your 32nd birthday, have a big party because you'll be a billion seconds old.
That's a good way to look
but
at it.
In verse 12 days, so there's a huge difference between a million and a billion.
Yeah. Which planet is the farthest away? It's a billion. Is it two?
It depends upon whether you include poor demoted Pluto or not, which is still getting people upset.
Let's skip Pluto.
That's what the AAS has decided to do. But you know, and like you'll see in any lecture audience, people are still upset about that.
I know they are. Yeah. Is it Saturn?
Well, Neptune is the farthest of the real planets, the bona fide planets.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out which one is a billion miles away.
That's Saturn. It's almost
a billion miles away.
Almost a billion.
Mm-hmm. How do you take in those numbers? When you guys study this, well, how do you take that in?
You take analogies, and like, again, for school groups, we go, you know, how long would it take you to drive out to Saturn on your bus after the show? And go 70 miles an hour, and it would take a couple thousand years.
Wow.
Or light. You take light. Now, knowing that light takes could go around the Earth in 1 second, 8.5 times in 1 second. So we can all picture, maybe, the planet Earth and 8.5 trips around the Earth in 1 second. So how far could light go in a trillionth of a second? Just to get an idea of a trillion, going now from million to billion to trillion, a foot. Light travels a foot in a nanosecond, a trillionth of a second. So you can sort of get what 1 foot is to 8.5 times around the Earth is what a trillion is. And so a light year, well, it's 6 trillion miles. So then using these stepping stones, maybe I'm fooling myself, but you can sort of think that you've got a handle on it.
Right.
These distances.
Yeah. Let's welcome some phone calls. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. We have two astronomers, both named Bob, in our studio today. I should give them different names, but I don't know what. Bob Berman, author of this terrific book. It was very, very highly reviewed, and I loved it. It's about the sun's heartbeat, and other stories from the life of the star that powers our planet. He's a columnist for Astronomy Magazine, and he's written a lot of other books as well. Bob Bonadour is Planetarium Director for the Milwaukee Public Museum, and he is the creator of a number of shows there. He did Cleopatra's Universe, Galileo, Secrets of the Dead Sea, and Cosmic Colors, which is the current show right now. He also has a live Valentine show for couples, Romancing the Stars, which has been going on for 20 years. That's nice. Isn't that nice? And both our guests have been all over the world on these solstice celebrations and eclipses, and we'll talk to them about that as well. So it's kind of like everything's on the table. What time is your speech tonight?
Seven o'clock.
Seven o'clock tonight, yes, at the planetarium, and then the show.
The show is right afterwards.
So it's a big night at the planetarium in Milwaukee. A fun night. We go to your phone calls momentarily. We have a ton of calls actually coming in, and we also have this talk thing you can use, talk@wpr.org, or you can go to our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Leave your messages in any number of places. Back to you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. I was having a really good morning until I found out that I've already passed my 2 billionth second day and I'm well into my 3rd billionth. I wanted to, but you learned something on Wisconsin Public Radio that I think he said 12 days and 32 years. That is really the kind of thing that sticks in your mind forever.
Yes.
Anyway, I wanted to mention a book, Two Moons by Thomas Mallon. Call is probably more appropriate for one of your book programs, but it's about a 30-ish math prodigy woman who's assigned to the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., right after the Civil War, which would be the last transit of Venus, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And the whole point is these days that when we talk about dancing with the stars, we get one thing. If we listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, we really learn a great deal. And Mallon was also the guy who wrote Henry and Clara about the couple that was in the Ford Theater box when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated.
Oh.
And he has a new book out on Watergate. I'm immensely enjoying this program, despite the fact that I've just been reminded I'm very old. And I think when you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, as to these two astronomers, even if you're not that much into astronomy, boy, you're sure to learn something in the process.
Yeah,
so
well, and
you.
Rich, let me just tell you, I know Rich because he traveled to Springfield and to Washington and Gettysburg with us. You are a young guy, Rich. He's gone, but he is young. he is young. He's got a mind that's very young. Do you know this book?
Mm-mm.
I
nope.
don't either. All
nope.
right, there's something new as well. Thomas Mallon. Tell me, before we go back to phone calls, both of you have done solar eclipse tours in various parts of the world. Tell me where you have gone and why you do those kinds of
we
journeys.
We shared them. Actually, we were just discussing it before we came into
really?
The studio. Because there is nothing in life that is more... I can't even have words for it. More inherently gut-wrenching, touches your soul like a total solar eclipse.
Really?
Everybody thinks they know it. They're like, oh, yeah, it turns dark during the daytime. But if it was just darkness, you know, you'd just not pay your electric bill or lock yourself in the closet. You know, darkness
right.
isn't special. What's special is that you're seeing the sun and the moon and your spot line up and these flames, these geysers of nuclear flame coming out of the edge of the sun, and people weep and animals
really?
Go crazy.
They do cry.
It's like nothing else. And they're rare. They only happen every 360 years, Freddie. Oh. Given place on Earth, which is why you almost always have to travel. And that's why we've traveled.
Right.
We've been to a few of the same.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Tell me about one, two.
Oh, my first one was in Aruba in 1998. And I was telling Bob, as he mentioned, I mean, you really connected with people long ago who thought the world was ending. I mean, as an astronomer, I knew what was happening. The moon was just simply passing in front of the sun. But as it got dark, you really sense this eerie feeling that the world was coming to an end, possibly. And I know it wasn't, but it was just, and it's so dramatic and so beautiful, too.
Really?
I mean, it's stunningly gorgeous. And you know, we're fumbling for words here because that's what it's beyond words. It's beyond so words. Inarticulate.
It's also it's like no other type of eclipse. People see lunar eclipses or they see partial solar eclipses like the one we're going to have next month, and people say, oh, I've seen an eclipse. But a total solar eclipse is in a different category. It's sort of like people say, oh, yeah, I've had a romance. And then if they've had a real romance, then they go, oh, that's what true love
now
is.
Now we
like.
Know what you're talking about. Now we get it. Yeah. And why do the animals, what do the animals do and why do they respond that way?
They think it's nighttime, so they start going into that behavior.
Right. Unless they're also sensing what we can sense, because it almost throws you backward. There's something that happens, yes, that's so different from any other earthly experience. One person in one of my groups said that they felt it was the home of their soul. Hmm. And Bob said one of his people said, what comment?
Oh, the world's upside down. Huh. It was a young girl. She was 10 years old, and she thought that the world was literally upside down. That was her metaphor of, because everything's out of place.
Yeah.
But in 5 years, our continent, or our nation, America, is finally going to get a total solar eclipse.
We are.
And we have one in 38 years.
Yeah.
Really? And in 5 years.
And yeah, August of 2017, it's going to go from like Oregon to South Carolina, and we encourage people to see that.
You've got to travel to it. It's only a narrow ribbon, about 100 miles wide. So in that path from, again, the Pacific Northwest to the Carolinas, you have to see in advance where that's going to pass totality and get yourself to that place. Of course, check the weather a day or two or three ahead of time to make sure you're not clouded out, and then do it. I've never yet met a person who went to one who didn't say that it was more than they expected. And so coming up in just 5 years, August 21st of 2017.
August 21st, we'll mark it in our calendars, which we don't have yet, but we will.
Plan for it now.
That's great. Okay.
And we have a little partial one coming up on May 20th, so just a few weeks away. The last 50 minutes here in our hour or so in Wisconsin, we're going to see the moon take a big bite out of the sun, and it'll go right into sunset. So Sunday night, May 20th. Check it out.
And there's something coming up with Venus, right?
Venus will cross the face of the sun on June 5th, and for Wisconsin people, start a little after 5 o'clock and go again into sunset, and that will not happen again until another 105 years.
So no one alive will see this again. Now, honestly speaking, that does not have the knock you backward impact, because using protection. Now, you need shade number 12. Goggles, welder's goggles, because they're very, very clear. You get them at any welding supply store. That's never the mall, by the way. It's usually the worst part of town where some snarling dogs are behind fences. Go to a welding supply store. Do it now while they still have them. And shade number 12, when the sun is low in particular, you don't want it at 14s because they'll make the image too dark. And that's safe because you do need eye protection for that. And then you'll see Venus as a little tiny dot over it. And if you want to know the really best way to do it, but you have to make sure to do this right. And if you don't think you can, then don't do it. And that is, binoculars are the best, but you have to put those welding goggles in front of the binocular. In other words, over the big lens, not the little lens that your eye's next to, but the objective lens, the big lens. Right. Yeah. Use duct tape. And it must be very, very secure, because you don't want to hand this to a kid and the thing falls off and the child's blind for the rest of their life. First of all, you'll get sued. We'll get sued for even saying this here. So only if you can do that. But if you feel you're handy enough to really duct tape this thing on so it's not going to fall off, then you've got the perfect instrument.
Now you know why we like this guy as a guest. Now you know.
On a more practical note and a shameless plug, we do sell some eclipse glasses at the museum for just a couple of dollars
down the road. Oh man, you guys are funny. Mark in River Falls. Hi.
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 I have a little bit of a technical question. I was wondering if either of your guests could explain how the temperature of the sun's atmosphere is inferred from spectroscopy. And if they have the time, why do they think the solar corona is hotter than the lower layers, like the photosphere? I'll take my response off the air.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, it's hotter. We know that it's hotter because, for one thing, you only have plasma out there. Plasma means that the atoms are broken. At least on the solar surface, we have actual atoms. But there, it's so intensely hot that atoms can't even exist. So you have the fourth state of matter, which is like just broken pieces of atoms, loose protons, loose electrons. So why is it so hot? And it was a puzzle for a long time. The surface is only 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Why should you get up to 2 million degrees hotter? Actually, just over the surface, it actually cools enough to have steam. The sun actually has a little steam layer around it. Most stars have steam around them. That's pretty cool. But then it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. Well, now we know it's because of magnetism, because magnetic field lines, of all things, snap open, they disconnect, and they release a lot of energy. And that's what's heating up the stuff outside of the sun's atmosphere.
Right. The millions of degrees. And just to link it back to eclipses, the corona, that hot atmosphere, that's that ghostly thing that surrounds the sun during a total solar eclipse.
You get to see it.
And it's that's part of the beauty of it. And it's just
The material. You see, ordinary neutral atoms can't follow a magnetic field. They ignore a magnetic field. But the plasma doesn't. It's channeled by it. So what you see during a solar totality is stuff that's coming off in a pattern, a curving pattern, the way when we were kids, sometimes we'd pour iron filings on a piece of paper with a magnet under it. Remember in school?
Sure, sure.
You know, you'd see the magnetic field lines.
Yeah.
You see those around the sun. You actually see the field lines of magnetism made visible because the plasma is following them, leaving the sun and crossing your sky and going farther away from the sun than you'd ever think possible. Mm. And all these things are starkly visible for the first time. You go, whoa.
Yeah.
Mm. But the science, even the science of this, drops off. I don't know about Bob here, but when I'm looking at that, I don't say to myself, oh, look at that. There's the magnetic field lines. Instead, your mouth is open and you're drooling. That's what's really happening.
Let's go to Chris in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
I have two unrelated questions. First, the moon is receding. One public figure said that eventually it will shatter. I don't understand why. And secondly, about the shape of the universe, I understand the concept of finite and unbounded, and I understand the concept of a universe that curves back on itself. Is the latest thinking that the universe is finite and unbounded and does not curve back on itself?
No. And the first question, which was what?
The moon.
Shattering.
Oh, yeah. It's leaving us by an inch and a half a year. So it is spiraling away from us. We're losing the moon an inch and a half a year. That's because as Earth slows down, a lot slower than most people think, actually, at the end of a long lifetime, at the end of a century, the day is only 1/700th of a second slower. Earth turns that much, that little bit of a change, and some of that energy has to go somewhere. The moon gains the energy we lose, so it's using that to gain distance from us. So it's leaving us by an inch and a half a year. Eventually, it's going to be far enough away that our day and its month is the same, 40 days. Yeah. So our day will be 40 days, its month will be 40 days. One hemisphere of Earth will have the moon, and then people on the other side of Earth, where presumably real estate values will be lower.
Yep.
They'll never have the moon. They'll never have a beautiful full moon. They won't have the moon. But then that can't last because then the sun steps in. And then the sun starts changing the Earth's speed even slower. And now the moon loses energy, spirals in, and that's why ultimately comes too close, breaks up in pieces, we get a ring like Saturn.
Yeah. Yeah. Back in the days of the dinosaurs, our day was only 18 hours.
And, really?
Yeah. So it's changed. I mean, you have to think of our Earth as a dynamic planet. It's always changing, the whole system. But our lifetimes are so short compared to some of these astronomical and geological time frames. So, and again, back to eclipses, as the moon moves away from us a little bit, I can't remember the exact years, but we won't have total eclipses. The moon will be too small.
To cover the sun.
To cover the sun.
It's interesting that they're happening now while people are on the planet. Huh. It's just a very nice fact. I mean, it's an interesting coincidence that we have only two disks in our sky. Think about it. The night sky has just little dots. Planets look like dots. Stars are dots. There's only two disks, the sun and the moon, and they're the same size. So that the moon can perfectly cover the sun to allow these eclipses. And it wasn't the case in the past. And as Bob just said, it won't be the case in the future.
Right.
Now, his other question, I think, is even more amazing. This is the most amazing thing for me this current year. He asked whether the universe is finite and unbounded. And that's what we used to think. Used to meaning a few years ago.
Like the surface of a balloon or something comes back upon itself.
In other words, you never reach a wall. but there's only a specific amount of inventory that you could, if you had the time and the patience, you could count all the galaxies and all the amount of energy. It was said to be 10 followed by 50 zeros tons. That's what's here. But there's never a wall. So as you travel farther and farther, let's say at the speed of light, eventually, maybe 100 billion years later, you pass the same galaxy a second time. You don't even quite know how it happened because space-time slowly curved on itself. That's what we used to think. Mm-hmm. But the new information, and I just spoke to somebody from the Berkeley team, Shirley Ho, who's part of the Berkeley team that just released, this is just a few weeks ago, the best ever study of 900,000 galaxies, giving us the best ever sense of the large-scale structure of the universe. And this is supporting what's been creeping up on us for years now, which is, and this is the most amazing thing, I'm glad this caller brought it up.
Tell us.
That the universe is infinite. Infinite in space. And that also means, because there's a mass energy density that's the same everywhere, infinite in content. So when little kids say, well, do the stars and the galaxies just go on and on? Now it looks like we're going to have to say yes. Oh, it goes on and on without an end.
And how do they determine that? About?
There's a number of things. The space is flat. There's a flat topology. It doesn't curve. If there was a finite amount of material, it would curve. Mm-hmm. We also use the redshift, the famous way things dim and recede from us. We compare a certain type of supernovae called type 1A with their redshift. We use baryonic acoustic oscillations. Those are sound waves in the early universe. All the data is pointing the same way toward an infinite universe. Mm-hmm. And can we picture it? No. And what does this mean for the observable universe? I actually just spoke to Debbie Elmgreen, who's the president of the American Astronomical Society, about this. And she said, oh, well, even if we can only see a small percentage of the universe, that'll still keep us busy because we can see 200 billion galaxies. That'll keep us busy.
I would think. Yeah,
even if we only see a small percentage.
Right.
But even though Debbie's a lovely person, she slightly misspoke because we don't see a small percentage. Because any percentage of infinity, Kathleen, is zero. So it means suddenly that what's within view, what's ever within view for us to study and observe, is 0% of the real universe. And that means our conclusions about the whole thing, well, I don't have to tell you how valid are conclusions when your sample size is zero.
Still worth exploring, though.
Yeah, you don't want to find another line of work.
Yeah, right. We're not giving up.
No,
yeah.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Chris. Let's go next to Steve in Hudson. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. A few years ago, I read in Scientific American about a bounce theory of the universe, not the Big Bang, but rather a bounce, and that the universe has actually been collapsing upon itself and then springing back out to a certain dimension, and then recollapsing again over and over again, mm-hmm. and kind of starting out with a clean slate every several billion years or so. Just curious if you had any comments about that.
Well, that was a leading theory. It was kind of death by ice, is the universe forever expanding, or death by fire, where it collapses upon itself and rebounds and starts a new universe with or the same physical laws or not. And that that theory is pretty much gone right now. We especially with the dark energy and the acceleration of the universe, there's just not enough matter to pull the universe back upon itself. So,
Plus, it makes the Big Bang, upon which everything is based. An infinite universe means the Big Bang had to be just a local event. So instead of being the birth of the whole universe, now it starts to look as if the universe did not have a birth. Because how can infinity ever be born? It's the implication. And we're still in the baby steps of this, so I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. But it suggests an eternal universe, and that the Big Bang was a local event. It was the birth of the, we could call it the observable universe,
right.
the neighborhood that we're in.
So does it also mean that we never really die?
Yes, because that's what you want to hear. I can tell.
Well, no, it seems as though it would bring to mind what, if it was never born, then you never die, right?
right? But, you know, when you cross into sort of the philosophy or the metaphysics of this, I'm always a little hesitant because is that why I have the microphone, to talk astronomy or to give my own personal metaphysical wisdom? So, unfortunately, it's an editing mechanism that goes...
But your head does that with all of this information in a way, too, doesn't it? Phil writes in, will the Milwaukee Public Museum show Cosmic Colors and Adventure Along the Spectrum be available on Milwaukee Public Television or video online, asking for somebody who is disabled and can't go to the museum?
Oh, great question. We do sell it as a DVD.
Oh, you do?
Yes, so they can purchase that from our museum gift shop.
Okay.
But that's a great idea. Maybe we can work with public television and explore that possibility.
Good. All right. Thank you. Dan in Drummond. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, I have to say for myself, from as young as I can remember, that the phenomenon that I always loved were the Northern Lights. Because where we lived, of course, we didn't have, being out in the country, had no street lights or anything like that.
Mm.
And it was just awesome on the nights that one night it'd be half dome shaped, and the next night you'd have the pulsating. And there was one 4th of July when our hometown didn't have the fireworks, so Mother Nature did. There
were
Northern Lights that night, they were all colors of the rainbow.
Oh, that's nice, Dan. Bob?
Well, I just got back from Alaska a couple of weeks ago doing a Northern Lights tour. We had a nice group of 40-odd people who came there to look for them, and happily we saw them. But everybody's going to see them because...
They're in the show tonight.
They're in the show tonight, so you can see them in just a few hours from now. But also the sun is heating up, and we talked about that a few months ago, that with the new solar max approaching, supposedly next year... And usually the Northern Lights peak then or in the year or two after that. So we can really expect, especially outside of cities, to have more and more displays of the aurora. So that's one of the exciting things about living at this this time.
Now, I mean, we're Wisconsin, we're a northern state, but it still takes a pretty big storm to reach down. I mean, we're 43 degrees north latitude, so we're not even halfway to the pole, but we're better than other states.
Weren't they visible in Minnesota somewhere a couple of
They were just
ago?
Visible in Wisconsin not long ago. I think the last storm, there were sightings here in Minnesota. So in last fall, we had one that could be seen right in the city lights of Milwaukee here in late October. So as Bob mentioned, the sun is getting active and there's going to be more sightings, and there's a great website folks can go to called spaceweather.com, and they'll send you email alerts and let you know when there's a storm on the sun and when when there might be a good chance. It's never a guarantee with these things, but
spaceweather.com. Terrific. All right. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. Bob Berman will be speaking tonight at the Milwaukee Public Museum Planetarium. And Bob's show, Bob Bonadour, Planetarium Director of the Museum, will be presenting his show. The speech is at 7. It's not a speech. It's fun. It's entertaining. It's a great learning experience.
He asked me to pick up some lighter fluid, so it's going to be a great talk.
Lighter fluid. Oh, my gosh. What are you up to tonight? One will only have to see. And then the show will be after Bob's address, so it should be a great evening at the Milwaukee Public Museum Planetarium. More calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have two astronomers, both named Bob, with us in the studio here in Milwaukee. Bob Bonadour is Planetarium Director at the Daniel M. Soriff Planetarium in the Milwaukee Public Museum. Bob Berman, astronomer and author of Strange Universe. He's the columnist for Astronomy Magazine, doing that column, and also author of, I highly recommend this book, and it just has received rave reviews too, The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. Let's go to Joanne in Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Bob and Bob.
Hi.
Let me ask you a question that's a lot closer than the origins of the universe. In the last couple of weeks, there have been two really bright stars on the western sky, and I was told they were Saturn and Venus, but they've been close to the moon, and they've been really spectacular. Am I right? Were they Saturn and Venus?
You're half right. You're 50% right. One was Venus, and a month ago the other was Jupiter, though that's gotten too low. Saturn's out too, but that's in a different part of the sky. It wouldn't attract your attention because it's not super bright, but Venus has. Look carefully. It's going bye-bye. It's on its way down now.
It's the number one reported UFO, too. So,
Venus is.
Venus, incredibly bright.
Hmm.
Well, Jupiter, that was Jupiter, the really, really bright one?
Venus was the very, very bright one and still is, and Jupiter was the one that was pretty close to it about a month ago, but now has gotten quite low now and harder to see.
Yeah, Jupiter's out of sight. Mm-hmm.
But, all right, thank you.
Thanks for the call. You did, for us, look at the night sky, too, which... God darn it, it makes me mad that I should know what all of those are. And every time I learn it, it's as though I forget it. But I want to be able, when I go to Minnesota and Wisconsin in the summer, to look at the stars. I want to know what I'm looking at. And you gave us a map. But it's interesting. If you lived in another time, as you said, that would have been your entertainment. And so you made up all these great stories about what was in the sky. Whereas now it's even hard to see the constellations.
Exactly. With the city lights, it doesn't pull our attention.
Right.
It doesn't grab us. It doesn't hook us as much. The caller before mentioned, you know, Venus, that still hooks us, especially when the moon is around and it's a beautiful sight. But as I mentioned earlier, the planetarium reminds us that there's this great universe. So take that drive. Take that 30, 40-minute drive. Hit a state park, county park, and, you know, pack a night picnic. Get your lawn chairs, a blanket, and just and make a nice night of it and explore the universe. And it's we encourage people to do that. They'll love it. It'll be a different night, and it'll be wonderful.
Yes.
Cheap date.
Cheap date, right? And one of the best kinds of dates, huh? Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, I'm pretty excited because I love the topic. I mean, what you're saying about expanding your views of the universe. And I recently heard a book plugged on to the best of our knowledge.
Uh-huh.
It was so interesting, so I had to go get it. And it's called UFOs. Generals, pilots, and government officials go on the record. And it collects a whole bunch of information and government reports from around the world.
Pro-UFO? Or, pro that they're aliens or skeptical?
She gathers... It's neither pro nor con, but she says that... It's hard to sum it all up. Her starting point is this report that was put out by a French official government French commission composed of generals and government officials to investigate all the different phenomena that was happening. And they concluded that 95% can be explained by just normal everyday means, but there were 5% that they could not find any explanation.
All right, let's get a response. I don't mean to cut you off, Sarah, but we're running short on time. And
if they're unexplained, that's just what a UFO is, unidentified. It doesn't mean that there's visitors from the galaxy. There's things that people see. You need so much detail, they might not have gotten all the details right and so on and so forth. I'm sure this book, it's inconclusive. To prove the extraordinary, as Carl Sagan said, you need extraordinary evidence. No one has that.
And also, we never seem to see them, astronomers watching the sky all the time. And we're the ones who would be able to tell Venus from a UFO. And I'm a pilot myself. I do a fair amount of night flying, and I've never seen a UFO, although... Maybe I'm an alien. I'm just saying this to throw you off the track.
Oh, no. Here's the thing,
Kathleen. It would seem so suspiciously incompetent if these creatures could come from another world and pretty much keep themselves hidden, since that's what they seem to want to do. They're not landing on the White House lawn or anything. And yet they're caught by this guy in this field. They're caught by this farmer who sees them. And they're like cat burglars, but incompetent cat burglars that keep getting spotted once in a while, now and then, even though they want to generally keep themselves hidden. It just seems like a level of incompetence that extraterrestrials actually wouldn't have.
Yeah. UFOs didn't start till the space age, really. I mean, no one saw them before that.
And why those ramps? you know, why always those ramps? I mean, is it a handicap? Are they from like handicapped access planets or something? Because our private jets just have stairs coming down. I never really understood those either.
I really want one to come. I want the world to change because it would change everything.
It would.
I mean, we have to be a good, kind, friendly.
Yeah, they say don't get in though. That if you actually have
don't
one,
get in
land,
one,
yeah, don't. If they actually land on your door, don't get in.
Why?
I don't know. That's what I've heard.
You have, huh? Okay.
Don't talk to strangers.
All right. Can we do one more call? We have one more minute, everybody. That's it. Alex in Toma. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I'll try and fit this in as quick as I can. I have a question about comets. I think many astronomers agree that comets can't last more than, 100,000 years due to they're always losing mass. Now, there's a proposed Oort cloud and a it's supposed to be 50,000 astronomical units away from Earth. And I'm just wondering, what evidence can you get to support an Oort cloud? And if not, how do we explain comets?
All right, we have about 35 seconds.
Well, the Oort cloud is there because these comets have to come from somewhere. So that we don't see it visually, we know by the number of comets that come in, we got a sense of the Oort cloud and how many comets are there. So something disturbs them. It could be a passing star, just gets slightly close, and that juggles its orbit a little bit and falls to the sun. And we see them in the sky. We have not had a bright comet that generally people could see since Comet Hale-Bopp in 97.
Right.
And so we're due for a bright one in our sky, hopefully.
Right on time. Thank you. Thank you both so much. Have a terrific time tonight. I hope you have a great audience, and we're anxious to see what the heck you're going to do with lighter fluid.
Thank you, Kathleen.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks so much. Our guest, Bob Berman, author of Strange Universe, columnist for Astronomy Magazine. His latest book, and it's really worth a read, is The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. Bob Bonador is planetarium director at the Daniel Soreff Planetarium in the Milwaukee Public Museum. And he did the show that's there right now, Cosmic Colors. He's done many other shows, and both these guys have been to taking groups to solar eclipses in various parts of the world. Well, that was fun. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Brett Jaspers for on-air production. Great conversations ahead.